This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will talk with the president of the Louisiana Association of Educators, Debbie Moe, and Debbie will comment on a few things happening at the Capitol, including yesterday's decision by the Louisiana House on a lopsided 60-31 tally to not overhaul the East Baton Rouge Parish school system and give more power to principals. We'll talk with Debbie Moe about this and more. Also, the poet from Baton Rouge, who has gained national attention for his work, Chancellor Zero Skidmore, he's in-house to discuss his work. We'll, of course, remember Maya Angelou. And George Hincapie, the cyclist who was with Lance Armstrong every step of the way and exposed him as a doper, he's written a book about his experiences. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us through email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our leadoff guest is Debbie Moe. She's president of the Louisiana Association of Educators. She was a classroom teacher for 38 years before taking over the position as LAE's top official last July. A French teacher from Kaplan High in Vermilion Parish, and she is now monitoring the comings and goings of bills in the legislative process. And yesterday, one went by the wayside in a huge way. 60-30 was not even close, 60-31. 22 short of the votes needed for passage. Steve Carter was touting this with great force on the House floor, a bid to overhaul the East Baton Rouge Parish school system, crushed by the lower chamber, and it would have given principals more power and responsibility and, of course, would have stripped the school board of some of its power. What do you think?
Well, I believe that our school system here in East Baton Rouge Parish is a united community, and I believe that this bill would have torn that community apart. When we have principals working as instructional leaders, I think probably the least of their worries is when's the next contract for food in the cafeteria to be signed, which buses or bus company do I need to contract with to get the kids to school. These are the kinds of duties and the kinds of things that the central office, with its economies of scale, can better provide for the entire district.
This bill was supported by the Chamber of Commerce here in the greater Baton Rouge area. It was backed by the sheriff, Sid Gautreaux, the DA, Hiller Moore, and it only mustered 31 votes, so it was a huge defeat for the proponents, and some of the opponents, like Noel Hammett, I'm sure celebrated. I saw Noel with a huge breakfast at Louis' Cafe this morning as he was celebrating the defeat of his nemesis, Adam Knapp. But why was it not palatable? Was it because the concept of having principals with more control was unacceptable, or was it because it only involved East Baton Rouge Parish?
I think both. I believe that, as John Bell Edwards said yesterday, this bill is really kind of treading on the Constitution. Our lawmakers are allowed to create laws, of course, but they cannot create laws that deal with just one parish, or in this case, one school district. And though the bill had all the parameters in it, according to law, it was obvious that it applied only to East Baton Rouge Parish. We're not the largest here in East Baton Rouge Parish. The largest school system is actually Jefferson Parish. It did not apply to Jefferson Parish because of the population parameters. It didn't apply to Lafayette Parish. It didn't apply to Shreveport. It only applied to East Baton Rouge.
Well, Steve Carter, the chair of the House Education Committee, who led a successful charge in the Louisiana House to keep an unconstitutional sodomy law on the books, he scored victory there but was defeated rather resoundingly yesterday. He has been successful to this point in preserving Common Core, despite the governor going against his erstwhile supporters like Representative Carter. What's your take on Common Core and where we are with a few days left in the session?
Well, I think that the Common Core, as it's being implemented in Louisiana, is going to continue. LAE's take on the Common Core is that we do believe in strong standards. But we believe that the standards need to be either created or at least vetted by practicing Louisiana public school teachers. We believe that the Common Core probably is a good set of standards, except perhaps the lowest of the grades in K through 3. That is where we're getting the most complaints from our teachers, that the standards are not age appropriate. So we would love to see, and I think there's going to be a revival of the ACE committee, the Accountability Commission in Education, to look at the Common Core standards and to look at BAM as well. And hopefully we can look at those standards and begin to look at whether or not they are age appropriate.
297-5633 in our remaining time with Debbie Moe, the president of the Louisiana Association of Educators. And this has been an unusual session, and that Governor Jindal, who is often at odds with LAE and did not participate in the LAE gubernatorial debate in 2011, on Common Core, he has this session come to a position quite similar to yours. Do you find some curiosity in that?
Yes, it's been a very striking year. Lots of alliances that we never believed were possible, and especially our alliance in this particular matter with the governor. I think the governor is going to try to bring down the Common Core standards, but I'm not sure that he'll be successful. There are perhaps some who wish he would be. What we would like to do is have a more collaborative working relationship with the State Department to make sure that they are good standards.
Well, James Gill, in his column that appears in The Advocate today, says when Governor Jindal concedes he's thinking about a presidential run, everyone takes it to mean he's thinking of little else. Will you be backing him in his presidential quest?
Well, LAE does have a process for endorsing candidates. So as president, I would not wish to speak for the organization until that happens.
So at this point, the president of LAE is not ready to endorse Bobby Jindal as the president of the United States of America. Okay. David at LSU. Good morning, David. You're on the air with Debbie Moe.
Good morning, Debbie. Louisiana seems to have a lot of serious public education problems. So what have you done in the last 44 years with pre-K, which has been proven to be the answer?
Well, actually, I'm a high school teacher. As far as for what LAE does for our teachers, we provide professional development for them. The National Education Association also has guiding papers and guiding professional development that helps us to provide that to our teachers here in Louisiana.
Other than Common Core, what are some of the other issues that are still in flux with a few days to go in the session?
Well, I do know that SCR 55, which is the MFP, is still not totally through the process mm-hmm. yet. That was a big compromise on a lot of our plates. And LAE did not turn in a green or a red card when we had the discussions in committee. We turned in a white card. We think that this is probably the best compromise that we can get, but we are disappointed in the fact that the 2.75% has disappeared from the language in the formula. It's very important that our school systems have that proponent of MFP mm-hmm. because their costs keep going up. They rely on this growth money to help them meet the costs, and with the Common Core, with the technology that's needed for the Common Core, the increases are going to be needed.
What do you see as the biggest challenges in education in the near term?
I think that the biggest challenge right now for education is funding. Here in Louisiana, I think we're closely approaching the point where we're going to need to look at revenues. Mm-hmm. And I know that Governor Jindal has not been a proponent of raising taxes or finding sources of revenue that would require either the citizens of this state or corporations coming into this state to pay a little bit more. But I believe that that's something we're going to have to look at very seriously in the next year or two.
All right. Cammy asks, how does Louisiana compare with other states, the Southern Regional Average, as far as teacher pay?
The last figures that I have, and I don't think that they're the most current, probably about 2 years old, we are about seventh in a lineup of 15 states. The SREB average is a moving target every mm-hmm. year. It's been moving a little slower in the past couple of years because of the budget crunches in all the states. But I do know that some of the states are beginning to look at increasing the pay scales of their teachers. So we need to keep up. We are in about the middle of the pack, but that doesn't mean we can't fall.
Well, and I remember not so long ago, Louisiana was next to last or dead last, very close to being 14th or 15th, and now you say 7th out of 15 southern states. That's a huge improvement.
Yes, it is, and I believe that that came maybe at the end of Governor Blanco's administration
it
when
did.
We received such a huge pay boost.
But that said, Governor Jindal's been in office 6 years, and you say it's a moving target. So have teachers received pay hikes during Governor Jindal's two terms?
Not that I'm aware of.
No?
No.
So even though it's a moving target, apparently other states are having some issues giving teachers more pay for their work. What's the average salary now for a teacher in Louisiana?
I think it's somewhere in the, beginning teacher, it's going to be in the low 30s, mm-hmm. not low 30s, the high 30s, low 40s. For a more advanced, experienced teacher, you're probably going to be reaching the mid to upper 40s.
Do you miss teaching?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I miss my kids, and I miss my faculty.
And you taught French.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And in your neck of the woods in Acadiana, that's a big thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I'm especially happy to see that Stephen Ortego's bill on French immersion is making its way through the process here at the legislature. I would love for our district to have an immersion program, mm-hmm. which it doesn't as of yet.
And here's another question from Janet about sex education measures being thwarted at the Capitol. Was LAE in support of the measure by Representative Smith?
Yes, we were. We believe that it is of epidemic proportions in some places, and we need to see about making sure that our kids understand all that they need to know in order to avoid these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Why is there this aversion to pass anything that has sex education involved?
Well, I can understand that most of our parents are a little bit wary of abdicating that responsibility to a school system. I think that Pat Smith's point was that there are caring parents who do tend to this aspect of the education of their children, but then there are those who do not. And those are the ones that are falling through the cracks, so to speak.
Well, it's a situation, as I noted last week with Steve Monahan of LFT, the lawmakers quite often are products of private schools, and many of them send their kids to private schools, but yet they often speak with supposed authority about what's mm-hmm. happening in the public school system.
Yes, and that is a kind of a particular pet peeve of a lot of our public school teachers. They do mention that to me from time to time. I do know, though, that there are some of our lawmakers who do have their children in public school and actually tout that.
Well, they probably should if they're a state lawmaker, but many of them do not, of course.
Right.
Well, we thank you for your first visit since becoming president, and hopefully this will be a frequent occasion.
I would love to be here.
We shall return with Chancellor Zero Skidmore in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, it's 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We're with Chancellor Zero Skidmore, one of the top poets in the United States, and he's right here in our midst. He is a man who has recently made an appearance, of all places, before the Baton Rouge Rotary Club. And at that appearance, Zero, you actually recited some poetry about a lynching, something that we probably don't hear that often as members of the Rotary Club, but it was quite moving.
Thank you. Thank you.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah, it was it's a poem about George Stinney, who was a young man who was electrocuted, actually. Modern-day lynching, I guess, back in the 1940s. He was 14 years old, little kid. There's lots of information about it on the internet, but I'd heard about the story years ago. I think it was actually, I was listening to NPR and I heard about the story the first time. And then it came up again. So a friend of mine, I think, sent me an article. And so I did some more research and ended up writing the poem.
Well, if you recall it, we might get your version of that is before we part company today.
Right. But yeah, it's a pretty lengthy poem. Well, it's like 4 minutes long.
Well,
yeah.
We'll have to time it out. But you're executive director at Forward Arts Incorporated.
Yes,
right?
Sir.
So what do you do at Forward Arts?
Well, I'm executive director, so I'm responsible for a lot of the administrative work, but I'm also the lead teaching artist. So me and my colleague, Donnie Rose, We get contracts with schools, both private schools and public schools, and we go into classrooms and we do poet in residence sessions. We might be in the school for one semester. We might be in that one classroom for the whole school year, and we do writing workshops right alongside with the English teachers.
And these are young people, artists and educators together. You have a lot of young people that you're teaching.
Yes, we just had our huge end of the year culminating event, which is the All City Teen Poetry Slam Festival. So schools put together poetry slam teams, and they compete, but they also participate in workshops and social events, mm-hmm. and youth town hall meetings, and so they really get an opportunity to share their voices and connect with each other.
And you competed in the national competition 2010, I think finished third.
In 2010, I finished third in the national competition, and then in last year in 2013, I won the world competition.
So I buried the lead in the world, the world competition, right?
Yeah, it was the individual world poetry slam.
So what do you do? Is it one poem, or do you have a variety of?
It's a tournament, so to speak. So everyone's guaranteed two poems, and so you go into the preliminary rounds, and you may not get past that. Mm-hmm. But I made it to finals, and then I stuck it out through finals until the very end. So
the world champ.
Yeah.
And it's like March Madness, a tournament, right?
Poetry.
But the world champ of slam poetry. Now, how do you define slam poetry?
Slam poetry isn't any particular type of poetry, but slam is a game that poets participate in where you go up on stage and you perform your poem and audience members hold up scorecards and they score you Olympic style on a scale from 0 to 10. But it isn't any particular type of poem. You could slam any type of poem, but it's the competition that gives it its name.
What kinds of topics do you generally focus on? Always as heavy as lynching?
You hear everything. It gets really heavy, especially on the adult circuit. It gets really heavy. There's a very strong youth spoken word scene locally and nationally. And the story of the guy who gets up and has a great day isn't very moving. So you hear a lot of poetry of controversy. Mm-hmm. You know, we try to go where the passion is strongest.
Sure. Today, the front page story, New York Times, as well as other papers in the United States, the death of Maya Angelou.
Yes.
1928 to 2014. The headline reads, "Lyrical Witness to Jim Crow and the Caged Bird." Did she have an impact on you?
Yes, she did. Before I even started doing performance poetry, I was lucky enough to attend a performance of hers in Monroe, Louisiana, back in the 1990s. And she came out on stage, and I mean, she just ripped into like five or six poems back to back, all from memory. And it was just astounding. A lot of them were what we call cover poems. So she was doing poems from poets from the Harlem Renaissance, like Langston Hughes and County Cullen. And it was just, I was mesmerized.
You grew up here in this area.
Well, I grew up in Plaquemine, Louisiana.
That's
but
this
I've been
area.
I've been in Baton Rouge for about 22 years now.
And how did the name Zero come about?
I used to work for a paper distribution company. I can say it was Unisource. Worked in a Unisource warehouse. And I used to take a few sheets of Xerox paper and I put them in my shirt pocket. And throughout the day, whenever I had a moment, I'd jot down a line or two. And so when I started going out to open mics, a lot of the poets had these really cool kind of stage names.
Yeah.
And I didn't. So I just took Xerox and dropped the last X off of it. And that was it. But I like to think that I'm full of potential, like a blank sheet of paper.
There
so.
You go. Zero with an X. X-E-R-O. Skidmore, Chancellor, uh-huh. The world champ of slam poetry. Well, these young people, are they sometimes reluctant to embrace poetry, or does it take some coaxing? How does it work?
It depends on the personality type. Some young people naturally gravitate towards the arts, as you know, and some young people are a little more insecure. I try to create a very safe environment. And when I say safe, I mean emotionally safe for them to take the necessary risks. There's a risk of getting up on stage in front of an audience, but there's also a risk of just writing something down mm-hmm. on a page and claiming that it is poetry. You know, you open yourself up to a lot of criticism when you mm-hmm. do that. And so I try to create a safe space for them and be as encouraging as possible. And also a lot of what we do is modeling. So when I walk into a classroom, one of the first things that I do is I perform a few poems for them. So they know that I have an authority as a writer, and they take me a little more seriously. And this, which is one of the greatest attributes of our program, is that we go into classrooms as mm-hmm. practitioners, as writers. And so, you know, not to say anything negative about most English teachers, but on a high school and elementary level, they don't necessarily publish work. And so, you know, for me to come into a classroom as a professional writer, it helps the teacher to drive home a lot of the things that she's trying to cover in her curriculum.
297-5633, the world poetry slam champ, Zero Skidmore, is with us, and he lives right here in Baton Rouge. What got you into this?
My mom. You know, going back to just modeling, you know, I saw my mom writing and reading all the time. And as a young kid, you want to emulate what you see adults do. And so if they're doing something that might be artistic or positive, then you kind of gravitate towards that. And so my mom was, you know.
How old were you at the time?
I started writing. I can remember writing very actively when I was 13.
13 years old. That's mm-hmm. an impressionable time.
Yeah.
But you have other interests, too. Yeah, I know you're a very talented musician.
Yeah, I'm a percussionist. I play with the legendary Michael Foster Project.
Yeah.
And I've been playing with them for about
Michael
7
Foster
years
Project.
Now.
And you look like you probably were an athlete in your day.
I was never an athlete. I played a lot of sports just, you know, around the neighborhood, sandlot football. Mm-hmm. I played a little league baseball, but no, I was very well. I was kind of an athlete. I marched in Southern University marching band.
Yeah,
so under Dr. Griggs.
Isaac Griggs, yeah, that's an athletic. He was like a drill instructor.
Oh
right?
Yes, you had to be in shape.
Yeah, I know that. He was in shape.
Yes, he was.
But there's a lot of pressure, peer pressure, to participate in athletics for kids who are you know, stout like you were. So did you get some razzing?
All the time.
How did you handle that?
I had to let people know. I had to show off my other talents. Because of my height, and I mean, being an African-American male, 6'2", I was this tall in high school. And so, I would always, why aren't you mm-hmm. on the basketball team? And I was like, well, I like playing trombone. I like playing drums. I had to really kind of make a name for myself on campus as I also sung in the choir too. Mm-hmm. So I had to make a name for myself as someone who was talented in other ways. And
When you were in college, you had to leave college, right? You had to go to work.
Yeah, yeah. My daughter was born after my second year of college, and so I started working full time. And but I continued to educate myself. I was always at the library. I read the paper every single day, and I was always really insecure about not finishing school. And so I think that probably pushed me to seek out a lifelong education.
You're in the community, Zero, and you're exposed to a lot of young people at impressionable times in their lives. How is the general experience different for a black kid in Baton Rouge as opposed to a white kid?
It's not as different as most people assume. I think... I work with, from time to time, I'll go on Facebook and there'll be some negative picture of two kids fighting or something like that. And people will say, oh, I don't know what's going to happen to this generation. I don't know what's wrong with this generation. But those young people that you might find on the internet doing something negative are not always indicative of the majority. Most of the young African-American students that I teach in some of the worst neighborhoods in the city are not violent, are not on drugs, do not carry guns. They're very positive individuals who are seeking out a positive future. And so for me, approaching them with that type of optimism is very important because it's just not the norm. I'm in the schools every day.
Well, I've got three people who want to hear the poem about lynching. We've got a few minutes, so if you've got it up here. So
yes, I do.
Okay, let's hear it.
I scream, you scream, we all scream. I scream for George Stinney, who at the age of 14 became the youngest person to ever be executed in the United States, if you can call being black in 1944 a person. In school, George enjoyed singing and acting. You know, those secretive interests that all homicidal psychopaths creep around in the dark pursuing. And yes, you do detect an air of sarcasm, but sometimes the obvious is oblivious on purpose. Before the bodies were found, little George volunteered to join the search party. Called out to those girls in a chorus of worry, he didn't care that they were white. He only cared that it was getting dark and they were priceless, especially to those who were of value. Earlier, the girls had asked George and his baby sister if they knew of a good spot for picking flowers. Obviously, this was a good day for hunting. George obliviously shared news of the interaction, but when genetics has already left your entire body branded, a hot tip can burn to the bone. I scream for ice cream. I need something to cool me down as I talk about it, as I breathe fire and incinerate old Southern courthouses, police stations, execution viewing halls. That Negro boy was the one that sent them last. Let's go get his. But why lynch an alleged maniac when you can electrocute a convicted murderer? Lynchings don't get defense lawyers voted into office. They grilled him without his parents present. Fired his father from his job, threatened to fire shots at the family if they didn't fire up a moving truck that night, and then they offered a 14-year-old boy an entire ice cream cone if he would just confess to a double murder. Is that cold, or is that cold? 5'1", 90 pounds, marched him into the chamber with a Bible in his hand, stacked it and dictionaries in the electric chair so his short frame could reach the only halo they deemed him worthy of wearing. That's a lot of high and mighty books for people with the moral elevation of snake droppings, the lowdown, dirty church-going judge and jury never tried to set the record straight. They only tried to set records 3 hours for a trial, 30 minutes to come back with a verdict. I've been known to have put more thought into whether or not I should delete an awkward line from a poem, muzzled and muffled. They even smothered the dignity of him voicing his pain. 4 minutes ticked away before they decided his brain matter had cooked enough. Imagine your blood vessels being pumped full of thunder beyond the duration of this poem, drowning in currents that no swimming could conquer. They never looked for a killer. They only sought out blood they couldn't retreat or resist or recant or reason or retaliate or repeat what they had done. On the day of the murders, everyone was hunting for something. The only one who found what they were hunting for was never found. Probably trampled more little white daisies. Probably was spared by more little dark orchids. Because if you are ignorant enough to hate enough, then you too can believe that a tiny kid could crush craniums as if they were carnations. We all scream for ice cream because George couldn't scream for himself. Because we are all burning with questions. Like, why does bloodlust always seduce those in love with power? And why are we shocked whenever black and brown and red and poor kids are singed by their supposed saviors? Don't choose to be oblivious. It's not an anomaly when some dirty cop or vigilante seizes the opportunity to scrape another dark child off the face of this earth. Isn't it obvious? It's more of an anomaly when they choose not to. But I know which question is squirming in the buckled restraints of your brain. I know which question is trying to leap from the viewing section of your oblivious death chamber gaze. I know which question is making the lights of your heart flicker like a set of eyelids connected to a power plant. Was George ever given his ice cream cone? Did those God-fearing post-birth abortionists ever give that little boy what he traded his eternity for before they burned him alive, tossed two scoops of Bible ashes into his casket, and thanked God for guiding their intentionally oblivious hand?
Powerful and poignant. Chancellor Zero Skidmore. Was that one of them that you recited at the world competition?
Yes, it was. And that poem didn't score too well at the world competition.
It did. Why
it did not. You're in a different room every time. It's some coffee shop or art gallery where they're having the different bouts. And sometimes it's just not the right poem for the crowd. Mm-hmm. And you have to, one of the strategies in this, I guess if you want to call it a sport, is the ability to read the crowd and select a poem that's going to score well. And so you get on the plane and you go there with
where
way
was it
more
held?
Poems than
where
you
was
need.
The competition held?
Spokane, Washington.
Yeah. All right. Zero was the world champ last year. You going to defend your championship?
I'm thinking about it. But I've been working on a book lately. I haven't been focusing much on writing for the stage. And so, the last year of my life has been devoted to this book I've been working on.
Well, we look forward to reading that. And the Michael Foster Project, the legendary Michael Foster Project, continues to do its thing. I suspect you're out and about in the next few days.
Out and about, yeah. We got some.
Where's
some
your next gig?
We're doing some private gigs this weekend, some wedding receptions. So I don't know when the next public gig
is. Yeah, I remember you did the 25th anniversary of WRKF back
in
2005. Well, keep up the good work, Chancellor Zero Skidmore, and congratulations on being the world champ of slam poetry. And we'll follow you. Hopefully have you back here very soon.
Yes, sir.
And we shall return after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. George Hincapie is our guest, 297-5633, if you'd like to join the conversation. One of the world's great cyclists, and he was with Lance Armstrong through all the Tour de France victories, the only man to be with Lance through the victories that ultimately ended in controversy. And George has written about his life and times, The Loyal Lieutenant, My Story, George Hincapie, leading out Lance and passing through the pain on the rocky road to Paris. Good morning, George.
Good morning.
It's a cathartic book, no doubt. You faced great physical challenges, as all cyclists at your level do, and conquered those and won the greatest honors accorded to people in your sport. And then controversy in a big way, and some people say you're a big part of that controversy. Let's start with how you and Lance got together first. How did this great athletic union take place?
Well, we met at a young age. I was probably 16. He was 18. I write about it in the book. He was a kid from Texas. I was a kid from New York. We were, at the time, starting to get well-known in the junior ranks in the U.S., and we kind of rose through the ranks separately, but together in some respects, and ended up where we were at the Tour de France several years later.
You competed almost 20 years, and during that time, it is now known that there was doping involved. When did that start?
That started for me about 1996, I speak about it extensively in the book. But the book is certainly not about doping. It's, for me, more importantly, how much the sport has changed and how I was able to see a drastic change and see a big cultural shift in the peloton.
And Lance Armstrong actually writes the foreword. So apparently you and Lance, if you had differences, they have been resolved.
Yeah, well, Lance obviously understands. Once the government comes asking you questions, you tell the truth. That's our duty as American citizens, and I don't think he has any issue with that. And yes, he understands why I had to do the things I did.
Do you think you got a bad rap, and that Lance got a bad rap?
I think we got what we deserved. We made wrong decisions. We participated in an era and a sport that, unfortunately, that was widespread. I think there could have been more, as we saw later on when the news came out about Lance, once a week another big rider of that time also admitted, and that never got as much press as to how widespread it really was at that time.
Just about everybody at that level, my guess, was doing this sort of thing.
It was very widespread, yes.
And Lance, for those who don't know, and I'm sure most cyclists do know, and those who follow the sport, but he was a cancer survivor. So he's a guy who certainly, when he was going through his treatment for cancer, had all kinds of steroids and other drugs that enabled him to keep his life. Did that affect him at all?
Well, that I don't know. I do know that he did not have a very positive diagnosis, and he beat that diagnosis. I think he had a 50-50 chance of living, and he used that killer instinct of his to beat the disease, and later on, become the athlete he was, and ultimately that's what led to his downfall. That he would, use that same, and he writes about it in his foreword as well. That his personality was ultimately the reason for his downfall, and I think he understands that, and he is repentant. And, I think he would like to move on with his life and focus on his family and hopefully be able to work within the cancer world as well.
The book is The Loyal Lieutenant, My Story, from George Hincapie, who was Lance Armstrong's loyal lieutenant and a great athlete in his own right as a cyclist. Are cyclists some of the best athletes in the world?
Well, certainly it's one of the tougher sports in the world. I mean, I've only raced my bike for 32 years, so I'm not the best person to ask about other sports, but I know that it is a very difficult sport. It requires an intense amount of training, and when you're not training, you have to rest just as much as you train to be able to recover for the next days or the next races that are coming up. So it is a really life-consuming sport if you want to be successful at that level.
Well, in the extra juice that you got was primarily designed to increase endurance, I would think.
Recovering endurance.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it involved blood, didn't it?
At times, yes.
So how is that done?
Basically, you take your blood out and re-inject it. It's a process that I'm glad I'll never have to face again, and I'm glad that it's not even spoken about in the peloton now. And riders are concerned about their nutrition and their training and their recovery and all the little facets that go into making them a successful pro. And I know that sort of X factor is not there anymore as it was back then.
What does that do, though, George? Did you really notice a difference?
Just helps you recover more. At the time when you do it during the tour, you're so tired that you don't feel like Superman the next day, but you notice that you recover quicker, yes.
Well, you have been quite successful since leaving the sport in the business world, and now you're writing a book, which I'm sure will sell a lot of copies. You were raised in Queens, New York, tight-knit Colombian family, and it was your father who got you into cycling, wasn't it?
Yes, my father grew up racing in Colombia, and it was a family sport for us, and it was basically all of his life was work and getting us to the races on the weekends and making sure we had the best equipment and everything that they could afford, they would do for me.
How does a kid living in New York City, though, have the wherewithal to go out and cycle at the competitive levels that are the best in the world? It's not like you're in a place with a lot of outdoors, and you have a different kind of challenge, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually speak about that in the book. I definitely did not take the traditional approach to becoming a professional cyclist. I grew up in New York, and I learned how to race a bike in Central Park. But contrary to what a lot of people think, there is a huge cycling community in New York City, and there is a lot of Europeans and a lot of South Americans that grew up with the sport and that are great cyclists, and that they go to these races, and it's their every weekend, it's their world championship. So as a kid, a 10-year-old, 12-year-old kid, I was getting pushed around by 20, 30-year-old adults that wanted to win no matter who got in their way. And I kind of got thrown into the fire, and I excelled in it. And I think that really kind of molded my career from when I got to the top level of the sport.
I have a question from a listener about Lance's cancer, and every one of these Tour de France victories occurred after his cancer bout, didn't it?
Yes.
Every one of them.
Yes.
And it is hard to win one time, much less seven times. How did you do it, independent of the doping, which you were doing?
Absolutely. That's a great question, and it's really remarkable that he didn't crash or didn't get sick or, didn't make a mistake tactically. It's 21 days of racing for 7 years straight without making a mistake. And a lot other than doping went into that. So it was definitely a remarkable story within putting aside, the bad stuff that was done.
And as the loyal lieutenant, what was your role in these seven victories?
Well, I was just on the support team, not only for Lance, but I was just seeing the book for many other riders throughout my career. I noticed early on that I was a teammate that can really put my leader in a good position, and I was a valuable cyclist to many teams because of how good I was at shepherding my leader around a peloton of over 200 riders on roads the size of bike paths, where positioning is crucial in many circumstances in races. So having a strong team behind you is crucial in the sport of cycling.
Well, Lance Armstrong was to cycling what Barry Bonds was to baseball, and the criticism of Bonds has not softened in the 7 years he's been out of the sport. Do you see at some point that America will embrace Lance Armstrong for the great athlete he was and put aside the scandal that ended his career?
Well, I'm not sure that's a question for me. I think he certainly was very passionate about his foundation, and honestly, I think getting back to that role is more important to him than any of the cycling accolades. I think he still can be valuable and can be helpful to people that are diagnosed with cancer, and hope to see him back in that world one day.
Now, as cyclists go, you're a big man. You're a big man, 6'3", right?
Yes.
So Lance is not 6'3".
Lance is not 6'3". No, I think he's just under 6 foot.
Okay, so you weighed what? And you're about 175 pounds, something like that, when you were doing this?
When I was at the tour, 165 pounds.
165 on
or under, yeah. Cyclists are extremely, extremely lean. It's all about power to weight ratio. So the lighter you are for the climbs, usually the better.
And very little body fat, obviously.
Yes.
And Lance, if you weighed 165 on a 6'3" frame, and he's 5'10", 5'11", what was he weighing in at?
He had a bit more muscle than me, so he probably weighed 160 or so, or under 160 at his peak.
And that's generally true of most cyclists, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, it's a book not only about what happened with Lance Armstrong and his amazing voyage to the top and the scandal beyond that, but it's a book about cycling. Do you think the sport will continue to be popular and perhaps become more so in the years to come?
I think so. The sport is in a good place now. Like I said earlier, I witnessed a huge change in the sport culturally. Doping is not accepted anymore, and riders are winning races clean. I can't speak for the whole peloton, but I've seen the guys that I was teammates with over the last several years winning races clean, and I was a part of that change, and the sport's in a good place now, and I think the fans can begin to start trusting the riders again.
Well, Lance, in his foreword, says, "I'm sure this book was not easy for George to write. George, unlike some, has never looked for attention or to cash in. He was a great friend and teammate, and the best teammate I ever knew. That man is George Hincapie." That's high praise from Lance Armstrong.
Yeah, I think I was definitely happy to read that.
Well, thank you for joining us today. George Hincapie, The Loyal Lieutenant, is the book from this man who was at the side of the great Lance Armstrong through seven victories in the Tour de France. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Bye-bye. And as we round it out today, there is a story in the current edition of the New York Times, and it reads, "Combat veterans of World War II have served in every Congress for the last 70 years, shaping foreign policy and a vision of the United States as the world's benevolent leader, willing to use its economic and military might as a global force for freedom. That era is ending in a quiet fashion befitting the generation that defined it." On Tuesday, Representative Ralph Hall, Republican of Texas, lost his primary bid after more than three decades in office, making him and Representative John Dingell, Democrat of Michigan, who's giving up a seat he's held since the Eisenhower administration, the last two veterans of World War II to serve in the Capitol. The next Congress, the Times continues in a story by David Joachim, the next Congress will have none. Well, not necessarily. If Washington Edwards wins his congressional bid later this year, he's running in the 6th District, Edwin Edwards would be the last member of World War II to be a member of the United States Congress. Edwin Edwards will be 87 on August 7th. Ralph Hall, who just lost, is 91. But Edwin Edwards did serve in the Pacific during World War II, and it is somewhat interesting that he could end up being the poster boy for the greatest generation, the last man standing in the U.S. House of Representatives if he wins his race. And almost every political prognosticator predicts that Edwin Edwards will make a runoff. Most say he will have a difficult time winning in a conservative district after making the runoff, but there is always the possibility that Edwin Edwards can win a political race. After all, he's done it on numerous occasions, as he himself has pointed out on this show, in 26 primaries and general elections for the city council in Crowley and for Congress and state senate and governor. Edwin Edwards finished first 25 times. He only finished second once, and that was in 1987 when he lost to Buddy Romer, and he really pulled out of that race before he was officially the loser. He did not go to the post in the runoff against Buddy Romer, gave him the keys to the mansion, and came back 4 years later and beat Buddy Romer. But Edwin Edwards would be the last member of the greatest generation to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives if he is elected later this year. The last member of the Senate to have served in World War II, Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey, died last year. And World War II service members were elected to Congress as early as 1944 when George Andrews, an active duty Navy officer serving in Pearl Harbor, won a seat in Alabama. So Edwin Edwards will be vying to once again be part of history, and this time not just Louisiana history, but American history. And we will, of course, follow it as it happens right here on this show and on WRKF. That's it for today. For Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.